Researchers have found over and over again that forgiveness makes us less stressed and ultimately healthier. It can help us get past difficult emotional times in our lives. But forgiveness can also be extremely difficult in practice. We will talk this hour with a pioneer in forgiveness research about how we can bring forgiveness and its benefits into our lives. And we'll welcome your questions and your experiences. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Do you have a story of forgiveness that you would like to share? Did you ever forgive someone who hurt you? Or maybe you asked someone for forgiveness, someone you hurt. How did that work out for you? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Robert Enright. He's a professor of educational psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Enright has pioneered the scientific study of forgiveness. He is the author of several books on forgiveness, including Forgiveness is a Choice, a step-by-step process for resolving anger and restoring hope. And we saw Professor Enright quoted in a recent article that was on Eon magazine, Forgiveness is healthy, but why is it so hard? And we have posted that article on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Professor Enright, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy, for having me.
So, why should we forgive?
Well, we should only forgive if we think it's a good idea. We don't want to just rush ahead like it's the latest health fad, only to realize that's going to be left behind in 6 months. But if we think that getting rid of our resentment and paradoxically doing so by applying a moral virtue of mercy toward the one who's hurt us, and we think this is sound and not insane, then we should go ahead and at least take a peek under the tent and see what this is all about.
Well, how do we know if it's a good idea or not to forgive somebody?
Well, we know that fundamentally it is a good idea for many who choose it, because this idea of forgiveness has been around for at least 3,000 years. It's time-tested. It goes back as far as the written word, okay? And so if we have that kind of longevity with a virtue like forgiveness, as we do with other virtues like patience, kindness, and justice, then it seems that it's on a very firm footing because it has historical precedence backing it.
Well, we'll get into the various benefits of forgiving someone in a moment, but how do we actually define forgiveness?
Well, forgiveness cuts across a lot of isms, and it cuts across a lot of ideologies and religions and philosophies. And as an egghead professor, I've had to look at that definition so it doesn't offend particular groups with particular thinking. And so I think when we boil it down to its essence, the definition of forgiveness is this, threefold. First, it's in the context of unfair treatment. You have been treated unfairly by another or others. And then two things happen when you decide to forgive. First, you struggle to get rid of resentment, and resentment is deep anger that is ongoing. And then, as I had said earlier, you offer the paradox of goodness of some kind toward the one who has hurt you. So it's deliberately targeted toward that person. Three themes. In the context of injustice, getting rid of something negative, resentment, and deliberately offering something positive to the one who hurt you.
Yeah, well, what positive things are we offering the person who hurt us?
Well, that's going to depend on the person who's been hurt and the relationship. It could be a smile, could be a returned phone call. It could be cultivating an inner sense that this is a human being who has done something bad, but they're still a human being, they're a person, and that I have to respond to them person to person. It could involve donating something to a charity in their name if they're deceased. So it's all going to depend on the situation, but ultimately it comes down to something that has a certain goodness to it. And by that I mean, you know, something that it could be compassionate, kind, merciful.
Does forgiveness mean we set aside any negative feelings we might have about whatever it is we're forgiving?
Nope, because first of all, as human beings, we react with anger and react with negatives. And in terms of the thing or the situation, we're probably always going to have some residuals there if it's really a very serious situation. But remember, we don't forgive situations or things. We forgive people. So we can still have some mourning that goes on, some regrets, some I wish it had been different, sadness, and even some frustration and anger. And we still can have that left over toward the person. But that doesn't dominate who I am. That doesn't dominate my inner world. And that's where the psychology of this comes in. Forgiveness basically targets anger. It targets the sadness, the depression. It can literally eliminate it as you practice forgiveness.
So how does it do that? If someone really hurt me, hypothetically, you know, infidelity or something, and I am just devastated.
Yeah.
How does saying "I forgive you for devastating me" help me?
It doesn't, because when you say "I forgive you," that's not forgiveness. Those are words spoken, perhaps in shock, out of obedience, because others expect you to do that. That's not what forgiveness is. You see, forgiveness, once we defined it, which is to get rid of resentment and offer goodness to the other, we have to then engage in a process. Forgiveness can be a long road. So we get in our forgiveness car, and we have a lot of stops along the way before we can reach our destination and say we have forgiven. And so part of that process involves, first of all, examining the definition, knowing that that definition does not include condoning or excusing what the other person did. What the other person did was wrong, is wrong, and will always be wrong. It doesn't involve forgetting what happened, lest it happen again. And it does not necessarily, although this is a goal, involve reconciliation, where two or more people come together again in mutual trust. And so when a person is forgiving, they're not saying it's okay. They're not just proclaiming, "I forgive you." They're not forgetting. And they're watching their back, okay? And so when they do that, then they begin to enter the door of forgiveness, what I call the work of forgiveness in my new book, The Forgiving Life, with the American Psychological Association. And you begin to start slowly to try to see the other person as a human being. Fallible, someone who can hurt, okay? But more than that, someone who is unique in this world. We all have unique DNA, as an example. And as you begin to see the person in their fuller context, and you see the errors they have made in this world, you can start seeing that, you know, they're not living their life very well. And after you begin to see that this person has a lot of potential, but hasn't necessarily fulfilled that potential, you can start getting a little tiny glimmer of compassion, which the definition of compassion is to suffer along with the other because of their foibles, because of their falls, because of their habits that can be destructive. And you don't just go along, because when you forgive, you always, without exception, bring fairness or justice along with it. So while you try to get rid of resentment, while you try to see some goodness in the other as a person and let that compassion build in you, you ask something of the other. Forgiveness is never isolated to itself. And when you begin seeing the person in this way, slowly, and here's the paradox of the therapy of forgiveness, you begin to heal as the forgiver, because you're getting rid of that anger that quite literally could kill you. It could, if you stay with it long enough over time and with a great depth of it. And as that anger starts to melt away and you have more positive thoughts and feelings toward the other, you begin to thrive as a person.
Yeah. Well, what are the health benefits and the scientific evidence that there are health benefits to forgiving someone?
Well, there are probably, I'm giving this a ballpark figure now, 30 to 40 scientific studies that are now published in peer-reviewed journals where scientists have randomized people into a forgiveness therapy condition or to another kind of therapy or just waiting until the first group finishes. And then we and other researchers across the globe put people through a process of forgiveness like I've just described, where they examine definitions, see the person, as a human being, cultivate compassion. And that can take, anywhere from 12 weeks to a year. And then we compare the two groups. And what we characteristically tend to find is that those who've gone through forgiveness therapy tend to reduce statistically significantly compared to the other group in anger, anxiety, depression, and they tend to increase in self-esteem and hope. In other words, they tend to like themselves better. And see, one of the devastations of very unjust treatment is we end up not liking ourselves. And I wish the world didn't work that way, but it does. And we recapture our sense of our own self-worth when we forgive.
We are talking with Robert Enright, professor of educational psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and renowned for his work with forgiveness. He pioneered the scientific study of forgiveness. And we are talking about why and how to forgive. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us a question at Joy Cardine Show. Do you have a story of forgiveness to share? Have you forgiven someone or have you asked someone for forgiveness? We'll talk a little bit more about that aspect as well when we come back. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about forgiveness and why we should forgive, the benefits of forgiveness, and how we forgive or even ask for forgiveness. And we're welcoming any questions you might have or any experiences you would like to share. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Robert Enright, who is a professor of educational psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, author of several books on forgiveness, including The Forgiving Life. And Professor Enright, you were quoted, as I mentioned, in this recent article that was entitled, Forgiveness is Healthy, but Why is It So Hard? We talked some about the healthiness of it, but do you agree? Is it hard to forgive?
I think it's extremely hard to forgive. C.S. Lewis, who did the Chronicles of Narnia and many other literary works, said, everybody thinks forgiveness is a good idea until they have to do it themselves. And I think the reason why it's so hard is because we have to basically reach out in a merciful way, in a way that the world would tell us we shouldn't even be doing. We should banish the person from the planet if they've hurt us and hurt us continually. And forgiveness takes the other way, which says, I'm going to take a gentler approach to this person. Not necessarily for me. See, forgiveness is not for me. It's for the other, because all of the virtues, whether it's justice, patience, or kindness, are for others. And forgiveness is a gift given for another person. And that's very difficult. And that takes time, and you have to nurture that. An analogy would be if all of a sudden someone comes to someone who considers themselves a couch potato and says, you're going to run a marathon with me. Well, that's going to be brutally difficult because they haven't trained. We don't train for forgiveness in our society. We train for justice. When we bring four-year-olds into pre-kindergarten, they learn right away what justice is. If they don't put their little shoes on right or sit up straight, they know full well, and they're practiced, they're trained in justice from a very young age, but not in a parallel virtue of forgiveness, which is virtually silent in societies. And that's the tragedy, because it makes it so difficult. If someone abandons you in a marriage, for example, or steals all your bank account money, and now we say, you have to run a virtues marathon. Come on, get up off the couch, and you're going to have to give goodness to the one who hurt you. It sounds impossible. It sounds insane. But if we can train people more where they get used to this and they practice it in the small things, when the hard things of life come, we're ready, and it's not so difficult.
We have many callers, so let's go to Rebecca in Waupaca first. Hello, Rebecca.
Good morning. I just wanted to share, I wish that I had heard of this many years ago, because my brother and I had a really bad falling out, and neither of us knew how to deal with it, and I disagreed with a lot of the things he was doing. So we just stopped talking, and it affected everyone. It affected our daily lives and our health even. One day, finally, years later, I got a random call from him, and he gave me a really heartfelt apology, and I realized in that moment how desperately I wanted this relationship with him, but that I still, you know, disagreed with everything that he was doing. And I thought, well, you know, he can choose his path too, and just because he does things that I don't agree with doesn't mean I need to banish him from my life. And so I did accept his apology. I do feel like I forgave him. But I still understand that it doesn't mean that I am okaying what he did. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's key. And I'm glad that you said that too, that you can forgive, but it doesn't mean you accept or that you are condoning whatever it was that was done.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. And also gives us an opportunity to talk about her brother is the one who, I guess, asked for the forgiveness, Professor Enright.
Right. That was a courageous act. And Rebecca obviously understood that. And her heart did go out to him. And apologies help us a great deal, because it shows the other knows they've hurt us. We can forgive unconditionally, without condition, without an apology, but apologies definitely help break the ice. And I think it's very interesting, and I think the listener should note, that she said the falling out with her brother even affected their health,
mm-hmm.
and it affected other members of the family. You see, these kind of divisions, these kind of injustices are wave-like, in that they don't just stay between one person and another. And when someone can apologize and then when someone can forgive, see, that's when reconciliation occurs. And you're never condoning. You'll never condone what they've done, and you might not accept everything about them. But as Rebecca says very wisely, you don't banish them, because you can't agree on 100%. And so they got their lives back and the relationship back, and I think probably a peace settled over that family that might not have happened.
So how do we ask for forgiveness?
Well, first of all, we have to take courage in hand, because it's a very difficult thing to do. It's a humbling thing. And so what we have to do is realize that when we go to the other to apologize, they might not be, as we say, on the same page. They might lash out at us. So we have to be ready to let the other person be who he or she is. And we have to allow them that time of anger, the time of confusion, and even rejecting the overture. In other words, our apologizing is not going to wrap everything up in a nice, neat little package and all is done. Because even seeking forgiveness through an apology is a process that takes time, because you have to work with the inner world of the one who's been hurt and give them time to work through their forgiving process now. And so, in other words, it's two imperfect people with two processes, one forgiving, the other seeking forgiveness, stumbling along this very difficult path of forgiving and receiving forgiveness. And we have to be tolerant of each person's path and how they go about this struggle, because it truly is a struggle.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Robert Enright, who is a professor of educational psychology at UW-Madison and an expert on forgiveness. And we are talking about how we can bring forgiveness and its benefits into our lives. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you have a question or if you'd like to share a story of forgiveness. We have Carl in Madison with us now. Hello, Carl.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi there. I attended a conference with Professor Enright a few years ago. Very good. You've been talking about cases where one person has done something to another, some obvious injustice, for example, infidelity. And then what I'd like you to talk about is more about the approach or how people approach it when it's not some obvious thing. And I'm thinking of an example of two people who remarried in their 60s when their habits and personalities were already largely established. And both are very kind people individually, but occasionally rub each other the wrong way. For example, one is very focused on diet. The other likes butter and ice cream. And they're not eating butter and ice cream.
Well, Carl, why would you have to forgive somebody for their eating habits?
Say again?
Why is forgiveness even needed in this situation?
Exactly. That's my question. In this case, it doesn't seem appropriate. But in this instance, one person's responding with a lot of anger towards the other for things that are simply a part of their personality.
Oh, all right. So I'm irritated that my husband leaves the toothpaste cap off the toothpaste tube and all sorts of other things. And I don't know, does forgiveness play a role here, Professor Enright?
Yes, it does. And here, and I'm glad Carl raised this point, because let's take his example, where one spouse is very annoyed with the other for eating the ice cream. That is a forgivable offense from the eyes of the one looking on, because they could reason this way. This person isn't listening to me. They're not guarding their health. I'm going to lose this person early, not because of some act of fate, so to speak, but because of a choice of lifestyle. I'm going to be left alone. You see, we have to allow each person to own their own judgment of what is fair and unfair. And we cannot rush to judgment and say, oh, you can't start forgiving that, because I never would. And I have 10 of my friends who have signed an affidavit saying they would never forgive someone, their partner, for eating ice cream. But if I see that the person is cutting their life short and therefore cutting my happiness short, let me go ahead and forgive, because I have deemed it an unjust act, you see. And so we should not stand in judgment of others if they want to forgive someone for something that no one else would forgive, because even if they're wrong, through the process of forgiveness, they may eventually stop short and say, hey, you know, I overreacted. It wasn't that big a deal. I don't have to forgive now. I have to simply accept who they are. Many will do that, but some will still forgive because they will consider it unjust, and I truly see that. And so we don't want to have a scorecard here and say, you can forgive this, but you can't forgive that, because that's my worldview.
And certainly I wasn't trying to suggest that it did or didn't need to be forgiven. I just didn't understand how ice cream played into it. But Carl, what about that?
That makes sense.
All right. Thank you very much.
I hope to see you at another workshop, Carl.
Thanks very much for the call. Elizabeth in Madison. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello. I just wanted to let people know that I forgave an administrator that we butted heads, didn't see eye to eye on working with students. And this was 8 years ago. I recently, in August, on National Forgiveness Day, had to forgive her because it has affected me for 8 years. I almost quit teaching. I was totally stressed out driving 3 hours a day to my new job, especially after this winter in the snow, and I said, something's got to be done. And it was humbling. It was scary, but I called her and I just explained the situation and how I was feeling, and I forgave her. And I even later received a letter from her, a lovely letter, and I'm telling you, it was like a 100-pound weight was lifted from my shoulders. So I just wanted to let people know that forgiveness really does work.
Thank you very much. Professor Enright?
I think that is an amazing story, because taking the 100-pound weight off of yourself truly is a choice. And some of us say, I'm not going to take this 100-pound weight off of myself until this administrator shapes up. Well, quite frankly, most of the time, the administrator or anyone else who's abusing us, let's say, could care less whether we have a 100-pound weight on our back or not. They're not affected by it. The one who is affected by the consequences of that person's injustice is the one carrying the weight. And when we make the heroic, courageous decision to cast that weight off, look at the influence that that person has had on us that's now melted away. They no longer have a toxic influence on us anymore. We are the one who are empowered then. We get our lives back.
Well, what about this National Forgiveness Day? Did you have anything to do with that, Professor Enright?
I did not have anything to do with that because I personally don't think you can wrap everything up in a day. And so I think we have to be careful with National Forgiveness Day. If it's a National Forgiveness Suggestion Day, I'm all for it. But if it's let's all sit down and sing Kumbaya by the fire, I don't think that's going to do it. Mm-hmm. And so we have to be a little careful with things like that, in my opinion. But, of course, it worked here in Elizabeth's case.
Let's say there is somebody listening now wants to forgive someone for an injustice. How do you start? How do you go about it?
Okay. First of all, I personally have a lot of resources, and the one I would recommend most highly is an American Psychological Association book called The Forgiving Life. It works people through 20 different processes of forgiveness. And here's the short version. I'm not going to give you all 20, of course. First, you realize how the injustice has compromised your life with anger and that 100-pound weight, as Elizabeth was talking about, or how relationships have unraveled, as Rebecca has talked about. And you realize you've got a problem, right, that has been created by another person. Then you have to decide whether you want to go on a good jogging program or read a good book or talk to a therapist in like with cognitive behaviorism or whether you want to forgive. You choose among the variety of offerings. If you choose forgiveness, you have to then understand what you're getting yourself into, that you're going to be striving to get rid of resentment and offering goodness of some kind toward the one who hurt you. That's the scariest part of all. Remember, Elizabeth used that word scary. It is scary because it's something new. Then you enter what we call the work of forgiveness. You begin seeing the other person as more than the hurt against you. You see the person as perhaps having suffered in their past life, in childhood, in adolescence, maybe early adulthood, where they themselves have been hurt by others and now they're bringing it to you. And then you begin to see that person in context as being wounded, and they've passed the wound to you, and then you have to ask yourself, am I now going to pass those wounds on to someone else, such as my children? And so you begin to see the bigger picture of forgiveness, that if you stay with the wounded other person's wounds given to you, then you may leave as a legacy in this world your own woundedness rather than kindness, you see. And so you then decide to give a gift of some kind. That's what mercy is, giving an unwarranted gift to the other, whether it's a letter or a phone call, as Elizabeth did to the administrator. And from there, you begin to see that what happened to you has meaning. I'm learning more about myself and about life and about wounds. And so you put what happened to you in a context that I am growing as a human being by meeting the suffering well, and that's when we see the psychological healing take place.
Sarah in Richland Center is with us. Hello, Sarah.
Hi. Yes, I just have a question. I just like his advice on what a person does when you are no longer in contact with the person that hurt you. Do you establish contact again, or how do you go about forgiving that person?
Okay. Well, I think it's typical. A lot of people have that problem where there's abandonment or the person had to leave for some reason or another. You can forgive from your heart even if the person no longer wants contact with you, because you can see them as a human being, as a wounded human being, that they have wounded you, and that you could pass those wounds on to others and you refuse to do that. you can offer the sense of bearing up under what happened and say, I will offer goodness if I can for that person if, in fact, we get together again. And then with regard to actual contact with them, I would think through this question. Would it be harmful if I recontacted the person? In other words, if someone has a habit of hitting me over the head with a frying pan, mm-hmm. and I tell them not to, and every time I tell them not to, they say, you deserve it, keep hitting me on the head, I will not make contact with them. I will not reconcile with that person because that person seems incapable of understanding the gravity of what they're doing, you see. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to forgive through my inner world of seeing them as a human being, being willing and ready to give them a gift of my attention, of my caring, okay, which they're missing out on, quite frankly. And even that, without actual contact, without talking to the person, can be deeply therapeutic in reducing anger and anxiety and depression. You see, you can even forgive the deceased because you're not going to be making contact with them in this world. But as I had said earlier, you might be able to donate some funds to one of their favorite charities in their name. And that is a gift to them, and that can be therapeutic to you.
We are talking about the importance of forgiveness, the benefits of forgiveness. We are welcoming any questions you might have or any stories you might want to share about forgiveness as we talk with Robert Enright, professor of educational psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a pioneer in the scientific study of forgiveness. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joy Cardine, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking about forgiveness with UW-Madison Professor of Educational Psychology, Robert Enright. And we have Richard in Milwaukee who says, forgiveness is an opportunity for self-examination. We must recognize that we're not perfect either. And we may offend others unintentionally. We should expect to be forgiven just as much as we need to forgive others. What about that, Professor Enright?
I think that's a very insightful point. In other words, we're meeting the one who hurt us person to person, imperfect being to imperfect being. That doesn't excuse the other. So we have to walk a fine line here and not get out of balance with that thought. And say, well, because we all mess up, it's okay for anyone to mess up toward me any way they want. No, and I'm sure that's not what Richard's saying. Richard is taking what we would call really the humble stance, what the philosopher Joanna North says about lowering ourselves to meet the person where they are in their imperfection and in my imperfection. And from there, not excusing the person, but saying, you know, I have messed up too, and I know what it's like to be forgiven, and the joy I can feel with that. Maybe I can give that to this other person now. He's talking humility, and forgiveness does come from a point of humility, meaning this. You don't want to hurt the one who has hurt you, and that definitely requires humility when we're fuming.
Dale in McGregor, Iowa is with us. Hello, Dale.
Hi. Hey, my question for Professor Enright is, does the forgiver eventually take responsibility for some of the actions of the whole situation and become part of the problem too? And I'm thinking my personal situation, I have a friend and his One of his loved ones was killed by a car that lost control, and they were walking along the side of the road. Well, obviously, that's very black and white. It was a difficult road for forgiveness for that person. But in the situation of infidelity, and I have some experience with that too, and in the road of forgiveness, it was a long process for me to go through forgiving, you know, the other person, many years. But as I went through that process, I seemed to realize more and more that I was part of the problem too. And what I was wondering is and sometimes I think we give, you talked about giving wounds. Sometimes I think the wounds we inflict for forgiveness are actually our own wounds we inflict on ourselves. I was just wanting to know if Professor Enright would comment on that. Thank you.
Yes, I think it's important that we put your comments, Dale, in context. When we have a long-standing relationship with another, we bring our imperfections in, both of us. And therefore, there is a tendency for, even with the best-intentioned people, to hurt the other and the other person in turn to hurt us back. And so when there are difficulties requiring forgiving on our part, we also have to realize we have also contributed. That said, it's not always the case that the one who is the victim of another's injustice has contributed to it. The absolute quintessential example of that is incest and rape. There is nothing any woman on the planet has ever done that would bring this on. There's no psychological theory saying that a man who has had this or that or this and something else happen to him then has a tendency toward this kind of violation. No. So there are some instances where a victim is truly a victim. And if we go there by saying, well, now we have to find our own problems in this, where I was also responsible, that's wrong-headed thinking. In other words, it's placing a guilt on a victim where the guilt shouldn't be there. So we have to contextualize this. In a long-going relationship, yes. In something that is violent and should never have happened, absolutely not.
Yeah. We've talked about forgiving others and asking for forgiveness from others. What about forgiving ourselves?
Aha! Uh-huh. That is a very important question, Joy, and here's my thought on that. We can violate our own standards. We can offend ourselves. And if we offer compassion and gentleness to others who've hurt us, then it's perfectly reasonable, it seems to me, to offer that to ourselves. Now, there are some friends, colleagues of mine, who think there's no such thing as self-forgiveness because they say you cannot be the jury and the defendant in this trial. And my response to that is, but forgiveness never takes place in a court of law because you need a third-party, objective person who hasn't been hurt here. So forgiveness isn't about the law, and I think that weakens that person's argument. And just as we can offer the virtues of love and caring and patience to ourselves and justice, we can be fair to ourselves, we should be able to offer forgiveness to ourselves, but with this caveat. When we forgive ourselves and have offended ourselves, absolutely without exception that I can think of, we have offended others by our actions. If we go around Dead Man's Curve at 90 miles an hour at 3 a.m. and we wreck our car and we break our leg, well, the insurance is now having to pay for my irresponsibility. I'm losing work, and so my employer is hurt. When we hurt ourselves, we have to ask the question, to whom do I go to seek forgiveness, to apologize, and to square it with them? So that's the one difference between forgiving others and forgiving ourselves. When we forgive ourselves, we do offer that understanding and that patience with ourselves, but we have to go to others to get it right.
Let's go to Mary Jane in Madison next. Hi, Mary Jane.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I went to one of your talks at the UW, had to be at least 10 years ago, and then I bought your book. I don't remember which one, but you spoke there about the forgiveness work and the studies that you've done, I think, in Israel and Palestine with the kids and then also with the rape victims. And your work has impacted my life unbelievably, doing a lot of forgiveness work, one of my dad for dying, and he's, of course, gone, and I can't speak to him, and I heard you talk about that earlier. I just had a lot of anger towards him for years, and once I went through your book and listened to you talk, I did a lot of work on forgiving him. And I've also done a lot of forgiveness work on myself because of a relationship I was in and how that negatively impacted myself and my son years ago. So I just want to thank you for your pioneering efforts and all the work that you've done to make this a true science and to make a difference in my life.
Well, you're quite welcome, Mary Jane. This is why I do it. I don't do it for me. I do it because I want to stop the disunity in the world. I want to help people to be unified either within themselves or with others as best they can. And obviously, you can't be united with your father right now in this world, as you say, but you can have that inner quiet or inner wholeness, or what I just said, inner unity, despite that. Okay? And with regard to working on forgiveness education, as you had said, that has blossomed quite a bit since I started talking about it 10 years ago. We now help children, and we have curriculum guides on forgiveness from pre-kindergarten through 12th grade, and an anti-bullying guide where we help those who are bullying to forgive others from their past so they can get rid of their anger and not need to bully anymore. And we're working in the Milwaukee Central City, Belfast, Northern Ireland, where there's been a history of war, Liberia, Africa, although by the order of President Ellen Sirleaf, the president of the country, there's no school now because of Ebola. We're in Galilee, Israel, and we're just beginning to work with the United Nations in different areas of the world, including Gaza and Colombia, as an example. So it's been blossoming.
Thank you, Mary Jane, for the call. Well, that reminds me, we did have a caller who, with all of the war and terror in the world, wanted to know, should we forgive people who commit hugely public acts of violence like shootings or bombings or other things of that nature?
Okay. We have to realize, first of all, that this is what we call secondary forgiveness. Primary forgiveness is when someone hurts me directly. But secondary forgiveness is certainly appropriate when we are emotionally shaken by something that happens, such as Paris, which you're going to be talking about in the next hour. And if we are shaken by the events where we're feeling insecure, unsafe, we have to keep watching our backs, yes, we can forgive, but we don't want forgiveness to be the opiate of the people. If we say, okay, I've forgiven you, peace and love, man, just go ahead and do whatever you have to do to terrorize me, no. If we forgive, that gives us more energy, more clarity of thought, where we can then ask the question, but what do we do about the injustice? You see, going after injustice is very different if we have a merciful heart than if we have a fuming heart. Because if we have a fuming heart, there's a tendency to get out of balance in what we ask for. And we'll want Shylock's pound of flesh as opposed to something that truly is just or fair. So, yes, let's go ahead and forgive if we're ready. And if we're not, we do need a period of anger. Forgiveness processes always start by legitimizing anger. We don't say it's a bad boy and anger should be banished to its room. We say, no, you have a right to your anger. And go ahead with your anger, but only when you're ready. Let's then talk about dealing with it so that it doesn't destroy you. And so, yes, forgive for those who choose it, but let's bring justice alongside that.
Well, I guess along related lines, David in Ironwood, Michigan is with us. Hello, David.
What you said really makes so much sense. I was talking about the Democrats and Republicans and the Muslims and the Christians' forgiveness. It seems like control has a big part. People want to control someone, and then when they don't do, they get angry, and that leads to hatred and all this stuff. And where if you direct that inward, help your self-control and maybe help them have self-control, it doesn't work. When you try to force people into doing things, it just doesn't work too well. Matter of fact, forgiveness is, I think, one of the best ways to get rid of hatred.
Yeah, so could that help our political polarization, Professor Enright?
Well, I think it could. And, of course, we don't want to use it as some kind of political expediency. and say, well, I'm going to forgive you so I'm going to get all the goods. But I think it would be good for those who are enraged with the other side, and let's face it, the political arena is filled with rage these days. I think it could help with more reasoned debate to really get at the truth of things and what is the best way to operate. Because I think when David talks about this issue of control, I think he's hitting something very important here. Because a lot of times we are hurt by those who want control over us. And then when we let the anger simmer and we won't budge, we're letting them have even greater control over us. And if they could only loosen up and realize we are a human being who has freedoms that have to be honored, and so do they, I think it would be a much better world. And I think if we don't forgive, if we don't make this part of everyday life, as justice is, I think our world is in big trouble. I think it's a tragedy that forgiveness is not given a voice in society to the extent that we overemphasize justice alone.
Very briefly, Elsa emails, I have been terribly hurt by my cousin, but my cousin doesn't get that she hurt me deeply. She's absolutely clueless. In a case like this, is the first step forgiving for me to write her a letter telling her that her action hurt me very much?
No, it is not, because if you're still fuming, the letter's not going to be written well. What you have to do is do the internal, the interior work of forgiving first. By knowing this happened, knowing you're wounded, see her as a human being who is not understanding and perhaps doesn't even want to see her weaknesses. People don't want to see their own weaknesses because it opens up that proverbial can of worms where they then have to admit to so much they can't do it. And so you have to see that in her, and if that kind of makes you feel somewhat sorry for her, that's the small beginning of some compassion toward her. And then be sure to bear the pain of what happened so you don't throw it back on her in what you write. And so once you do that and you truly want to give a gift to her through this letter, then it's going to come out correctly. So I would urge you to spend some weeks forgiving her first, and then let that flow out in words in the letter.
Well, we have less than a minute to go, Professor Enright. How do we make forgiveness a part of everyday life, or do we?
What we should, and I think my question I want to leave with your listeners is this: what will be your legacy in this world when you die? You could be leaving your own wounds to others right now. And those wounds will be like a virus and jump to another person, as these people don't think about forgiving and they keep wounding others. Or you can leave a legacy of forgiveness and love in the world. And you can start that right here and right now today by changing course and say, when I die, I want my love to live on. Because love doesn't die with you. It lives on in the hearts of others, and forgiveness can help you get there.
I love that. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're quite welcome, Joy. Take care.
Robert Enright, Professor of Educational Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks to Christy Taylor, to Cynthia Schuster for producing this program. Thank you for listening. Tomorrow at this time, it's the Week in Review. Two guests from different political perspectives talking about the top news stories of the week. This is the Ideas Network.